In Haiti, a new problem. People are fed up with the gangs and are now taking the law into their own hands, sometimes violently.
And, you know, this is just part and parcel of the spiraling, not just violence, but really brutality that Haiti is experiencing.
Also today, Yaya the panda in the Memphis Zoo. Yaya was a big draw there, but no more. China wants its bear back home.
A summary would be that China giveth the panda and China taketh the panda away based on its relationships with countries to some extent.
Panda diplomacy on the rocks. Plus, Eastern European farmers are saying yes to helping Ukraine, but no to the trade in Ukrainian grain imports.
The trade is the trade, and the war is the war.
And historians take another look at the terror attacks at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us on a Friday. Early this morning, Russia fired another barrage of cruise missiles at Ukraine. Air raid sirens started going off at about 4 a.m. One of the targets, the city of Uman in central Ukraine. A Russian missile hit a nine-story residential building in Uman. A local official said 21 people died in that single strike. The World's Daniel Offman is following the latest. What else do we know, Daniel, about this latest barrage of Russian missiles on Ukraine?
Marco, Russia fired at least 20 cruise missiles and a couple of drones at Ukraine. As of now, we know that 23 people were killed overall, and as you noted, 21 people were killed in the city of Uman. Rescue workers are still on the scene clearing debris because there may still be people trapped under the rubble. We also know that some missiles were aimed at Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. That's the first time that Kyiv has been targeted like this in about 2 months. Authorities there say that Kyiv's air defense systems were able to intercept 11 of those cruise missiles. Today, as a response, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for more sanctions against Russia and for countries to provide more weapons to Ukraine in order to prevent attacks like this in the future.
So for many months now, Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Is that still the strategy the Russian military is pursuing with these strikes?
When it comes to these missile strikes, Marco, Russia has two goals here. One is to target Ukraine's electric grid, as you noted, and other civilian infrastructure. And the second goal, very much related, is to demoralize the Ukrainian public. Life becomes difficult without electricity, or in some cases without running water. But Ukrainians have quickly adapted. Workers are able to restore electricity, often within hours. And in many cases, people physically are rebuilding their homes and neighborhoods. But taking a step back, Marco, beyond these missile strikes, over the course of the winter, Russia's military tried to gain territory in eastern Ukraine in an attempted offensive. Russia's military did make some small gains, most notably around the city of Bakhmut, but casualty rates are very high, tens of thousands of deaths. At this point, military experts say that without another large-scale draft, Russia's offensive capabilities are slim to none.
So here we are at the end of April, which leads to what comes next. For weeks now, we've been hearing about an expected Ukrainian counteroffensive, a springtime offensive. What do we know about that right now?
Yeah, there's been a lot of speculation about that counteroffensive. It has been a conversation amongst military experts who follow what's going on the ground in Ukraine. For months, Ukraine has been trying to beef up its force and prepare for this offensive. It's created new brigades that haven't yet seen combat on the front lines. Some of those brigades were trained by Western partners like the UK. On top of that, Ukraine has been receiving more weapons from its partners, artillery systems, long-range rocket launchers, and crucially, tanks. The big unknown is when will the counteroffensive begin and how will it unfold on the battlefield? Here's what Ukraine's defense minister Alexei Reznikov said today. He said that Ukraine's military is ready for the counteroffensive, and now they're waiting for orders from the general staff. So the next phase of the war is imminent, but we still need to wait and see what happens.
And finally, Daniel, as you mentioned, the weather is one factor in Ukraine's calculations. What else is weighing on their minds as they prepare for some kind of spring offensive?
The weather is a factor. Winter is over. Now Ukraine is busy getting this new weaponry ready to go. But there's another important factor, and that's the political reality. There's real pressure on Ukraine to show success on the battlefield. Ukraine has been receiving billions of dollars in military aid, and even Ukraine's partners are asking questions like, how long will this war go on for, and what does the endgame look like? There's some diplomatic efforts going on behind the scenes, but we haven't seen a real mechanism for peace talks since both Russia and Ukraine believe they can make gains on the battlefield. Ukraine's goal remains the same, though, to liberate all of its territory from Russian occupation. But perception and timing really matter here. So Ukraine knows that in order to, in a sense, justify Western support, it needs to show some concrete results.
The World's Daniel Hoffman, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
In the rest of Europe, the 27 member nations of the EU have been united, for the most part, in their response to the war in Ukraine. They've been trying to help the Ukrainian government and its economy. And one of the ways is by opening up trade routes through Europe. There has been an unintended downside to that. Some Eastern European farmers say they could face bankruptcy if something isn't done to stop grain from Ukraine now flooding into Europe. From the Romanian capital, Bucharest, the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has our story.
Janet Spitsa is a 44-year-old farmer in Tunari, a small village north of Bucharest.
Structura culturilor este formată din grâu, ors, rapiță.
And on his farm, he says, he grows wheat, barley, corn, sunflower seeds and peas. Spitsa has been working the land here for 18 years. He actually studied economics, so when it comes to the business side of things, he says he understands what's going on. And last September, it was clear to him that something was very wrong. Grain prices were plummeting, he says, and his buyers told him they didn't need any more stock. They had found cheaper alternatives. Spitzer says he knew that meant Ukraine. The problem goes back to February 24th of last year.
Russia's war on Ukraine has created fears of a global food crisis. The two countries supply a third of the world's wheat. Fighting has disrupted exports.
The Russian bombardment of Ukraine's ports meant there was no way to send Ukrainian grain to buyers in Africa and the Middle East, the country's biggest export markets. So the European Union came up with a plan. Send the goods by road, rail or river through neighbouring countries like Romania, Poland and Bulgaria. Then the Ukrainian grain could be shipped onwards from ports like Constanza in Romania to faraway destinations in Africa and beyond. The EU also agreed to lift any quotas or tariffs on Ukrainian exports. But some agricultural experts say they knew this was asking for trouble.
I advised them at that time that we will encounter huge problems due to Ukrainian flows because through Romania is the most cheapest route for shipping the grains.
I meet agricultural consultant Cesar Gheorghe in a coffee shop in Bucharest. He says he warned the government that much of the grain would never make it outside of Europe. The traders and factories in the EU would buy up the cheaper Ukrainian produce. And Romanian farmers would end up selling their goods for half the usual price. Earlier this month, thousands of those angry farmers took to the streets of Romania. Driving tractors into the centre of towns and cities. Farmers in Poland and Bulgaria protested too. But governments there and in neighbouring Slovakia and Hungary went one step further. They imposed temporary bans on grain and other food products from Ukraine. Only Romania held back. Cesar Gheorghe says the Romanian government was right not to break EU laws. And he says he doesn't think those other governments are really thinking about farmers' livelihoods at all.
From my perspective, there was also political interest. In Poland, we have election over 1 year. In Bulgaria, it's the same. And, in Hungary, we don't speak about Hungary too much.
But many farmers in Romania are furious with their government's decision to stick by EU rules. I ask farmer Janusz Spitsa what he thinks the Romanian government has done for farmers here.
Nothing. No response.
We saw with the other countries, for example, Poland and Slovakia, Bulgaria, they imposed their own temporary bans on Ukraine grain. Should Romania have done the same?
Categoric.
Definitely, he says, definitely. Along with Poland, Romania has been one of the main destinations for Ukrainians fleeing the war. And Ukrainian refugees here in Bucharest tell me up to now they've been made to feel very welcome. Svetlana Salamatova from Kyiv says she gets why Romanian farmers are protesting.
It's an understandable process. They have rights to do what they do. It's a normal process.
But then Salamatova adds,
I think that, and I know it for sure, that the system of thinking changing very much when bombs come on your head.
Meaning the way you think really changes in times of war. Everyone, Romanian farmers included, she says, needs to adapt to the new situation. Agricultural advisor Cesar Gheorghe says Romanians are still fully committed to supporting Ukraine. But he says business is business.
The trade is the trade and the war is the war. Like Romanians, we will never give up in our commitment to help Ukrainian people. But the trade is trade. It's a different topic.
This week, Romania's agriculture minister said the EU Commission is planning to ban Ukrainian seed and grain exports to Romania in the next few days. And the measure will last until June 5th. Farmers say that's just not good enough. They want to know what happens in a few months' time when this year's harvest is ready. Back on the farm, I ask Janos Spitza, after all of this, if he would like to see his two teenage sons follow in his footsteps and get into the farming business.
No. Deoarece ultimul concediu care l-am avut eu.
No, he says. And besides, the last time I had a week's vacation was 5 years ago. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in Bucharest, Romania.
I paid my dues time after time.
Queen and their frontman, Freddie Mercury, are legends in music. And now about 1,500 items that once belonged to Freddie Mercury are going up for auction. There's a lot of cool stuff, things that made him a legend, like the handwritten draft lyrics to We Are the Champions, which Mercury once called,
it's the most egotistical and arrogant song I've ever written.
The objects are being put up for sale by Mercury's close friend, Mary Austin, who inherited the bulk of his estate. She spoke with the BBC.
The collection takes you deeper within the individual and the man I knew. You see the spectrum of his taste, which is quite eclectic.
Eclectic is definitely the right word. There is a Fabergé gem set, a tiny Tiffany silver mustache comb for that glorious stash, and a hand-painted silk waistcoat featuring the likenesses of Freddie Mercury's cats, Goliath, Oscar, Lily, Romeo, Miko, and Delilah. Delilah was actually immortalized in this song.
Delilah.
In June, highlights from the collection will go on tour to New York, London, L.A., and Hong Kong, and will be auctioned off at the beginning of September. In a press release, Sotheby's London said seeing Freddie Mercury's treasures, the things he collected, it's like getting the ultimate backstage pass to his world. Given the joy that Freddie Mercury brought and continues to bring us, these treasures let us see what gave him joy.
So don't stop me now.
You are listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich, they were designed to showcase peace, joy, and cheer.
Deutschland.
It was the first time Germany played host to the Games since Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party oversaw the Olympics in 1936. But in 1972, tragedy struck when Palestinian terrorists stormed Team Israel's rooms in the Olympic Village. Last year, the German government finally apologized for what happened. Now it's going one step further. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
In 1972, Michael Brenner was 8 years old and living with his family not far outside of Munich.
And I remember how I was together with my parents so much looking forward not only to the Olympics right here in front of my home, but also an Israeli team coming to Germany. That was very exciting for a tiny Jewish community in Germany.
On August 26th, the Israeli delegation walked in the opening ceremony to outsized applause. The team's 15 athletes got right to work, competing in swimming, athletics, fencing, and wrestling. But everything changed in the early morning hours of September 5th.
Early this morning, armed Palestinian guerrillas raided the sleeping quarters of the Israeli team.
Shot and killed two Israelis and held nine others hostages all day and into the night.
The kidnappers demanded the release of more than 200 Palestinians being held in Israeli custody. German police tried to rescue the Israeli hostages, but that attempt ended in a shootout. In total, 11 members of Israel's Olympic delegation died. Brenner remembers hearing the news.
I remember the extreme mourning and sadness of my parents at the time, but also of myself, because I felt, oh, my Olympics were stolen. And this terrible thing that happened to those athletes who come from a place I felt already very much attached to at age 8, because we had family in Israel.
Competition was briefly suspended, but the games resumed the following day, a move that was widely criticized at the time. The victims' families spent decades seeking accountability from the German government. On the massacre's 50th anniversary last year, President Frank-Walter Steinmeier offered them a long-awaited apology.
Dem Anschlag folgten Jahre und Jahrzehnte des Schweigens.
He admitted the attack was followed by decades of silence and hard-heartedness. That is a failure, he added, and something he's ashamed of. The German government then promised to form a commission to re-examine the 1972 attack. The experts were named last week, and the team includes Michael Brenner, who grew up to teach Jewish history at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich.
The Minister of the Interior of Germany appointed 8 historians, some from Germany, some from Israel, one from the UK.
Brenner and the team are tasked with creating a comprehensive scholarly account and assessment of what happened before, during, and after the attack.
And mainly, how did the Federal Republic of Germany treat the surviving relatives, and how did they handle their claims?
Klaus Weinhauer is also on the expert panel. He's a professor of modern history at Bielefeld University. Weinhauer says they'll gather information on the attack through a number of methods.
We will meet with the surviving relatives to have a close exchange and some oral history. And the Ministry of the Interior said to us, well, you have open access to all files that are available in Germany. So police files, Secret Service files, and whatsoever.
The 8-member commission will meet for the first time at the end of May and will have 3 years to complete their work. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This week, for the first time, Portugal's president said his country should formally apologize for his role in the transatlantic slave trade. Portugal's role was massive. Many say this is a start, but that there's a long way to go. Reporter Michael Fox has more.
Wearing a blue suit and a purple tie, Portuguese President Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa stood before the country's parliament this week, and he said something extraordinary that should have been said a long time ago.
E assumirmos plenamente a responsabilidade por aquilo que fizemos. Não é apenas pedirmos desculpa.
We have to take full responsibility for what we have done, he said. But it's not just a matter of apologizing for what we did, because sometimes it's easiest to apologize, turn your back, and done. No, we have to assume the responsibility for the future of what we did in the past, the good and the bad, he said. The exploitation of indigenous people, slavery, the sacrifice of the interests of Brazil and Brazilians. We have to assume responsibility for the worst of our past, just as we take responsibility for the best of it, he said. During the transatlantic slave trade, 12 million Africans were ripped from their homes, transported across the Atlantic, and forced into slavery across the Americas. The Portuguese were responsible for almost half of the violence, selling nearly 6 million people into slavery, mostly in Brazil. Brazil was the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery. It didn't happen until 1888, and the practice still occurred well into the 1900s. Karine de Souza Silva is a foreign relations professor at Brazil's Federal University of Santa Catarina.
A manifestação do governo português realmente é simbólica.
She says the declaration of the Portuguese government is symbolic, but it's late and insufficient to confront the colonial past and all of the barbaric acts carried out during colonization. Souza Silva, who is black, says much of Europe's riches were made through the trafficking of people, slavery, and colonization. And people have been demanding an apology and reparations for decades.
Claro que o governo Lula cria essa ambiência positiva para a reivindicação.
Souza Silva explains that the Portuguese president's statement this week was in part due to pressure or encouragement from the Brazilian government of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was present for this speech in Portugal alongside Brazil's racial equality minister Aniele Franco. The Portuguese president's words came on the heels of an apology by Netherlands Prime Minister Mark Rutte last December.
Today, I apologize. Away. Mi tapidi disculpa. Tide, mi vani, taki, pardon.
He apologized in three different languages before continuing in Dutch. For centuries, in the name of the Dutch state, human beings were made into commodities, exploited and abused. We cannot change the past, but we can face up to it, he said. But these cannot be empty words of apology, says Marco Antonio André, a lawyer in southern Brazil and a member of Brazil's black movement.
Isso é importante, mas precisa ser dado passo a mais.
These statements are important, he says, but there needs to be another step. Recognizing guilt isn't sufficient. Just asking for forgiveness doesn't resolve the problem caused by more than 300 years of slavery in Brazil.
A responsabilidade do Estado português deveria ser.
André says the Portuguese state should be internationally responsible for public policies and affirmative action programs to end racism. The racism black Brazilians suffer today, he says, that the Portuguese state largely caused. Professor Souza Silva agrees.
E realmente é necessário que as potências colonizadoras investam em políticas.
Truly, it's necessary for the colonial powers to invest in policies for affirmative action, for education, for combating racism, and policies supporting nations that were colonized, she says. Whether they will remains to be seen, but that is what black activists and organizations in Brazil and abroad have been demanding for decades. And it seems the direction that President Marcelo Rebelo de Souza may be guiding Portugal. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In Iran, schoolgirls have become targets of suspected chemical attacks. Human rights advocates say the government needs to do more to stop this.
It is really sad that a place that should be a place of safety and peace for a student has now become a place of fear and terror for them and their families.
Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The Trump-era public health order, Title 42, is about to expire. On paper, it was meant to stop people with COVID from entering the U.S. In practice, it was a big stop sign for migrants looking for asylum in this country. Title 42 enabled the U.S. government to turn away anyone in the name of public health, regardless of their eligibility for asylum.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Yesterday in Washington, Secretary of State Antony Blinken introduced parts of a new program that will replace Title 42. It will include processing centers in Colombia and Guatemala, countries that many migrants pass through on their journey to the Mexico-U.S. border.
These centers will take a hugely important step to prevent people from making the dangerous journey to the border by providing a much safer legal option to migrate that they can pursue in and from their own countries.
At the same time, the Biden administration is planning to ramp up deportations. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the new policy will be strictly enforced.
An individual who is removed is subject to at least a 5-year ban on admission to the United States and can face criminal prosecution for any subsequent attempt to cross the border illegally.
Mayorkas also said the U.S. is partnering with other countries to stop the smuggling of people across borders.
We initiated a 60-day coordinated campaign with Panama and Colombia to prevent the incredibly dangerous humanitarian situation of migrants traversing the Darien jungle.
The Darien jungle between Panama and Colombia, that is. The rugged and untamed isthmus connects South and Central America. Reporter Manuel Rueda is on the Colombian side, where many migrants begin the perilous northward journey. What are you seeing today, Manuel?
Well, I'm in a town called Necoclí, where the road towards Central America ends. This is next to the Caribbean Sea, and then what migrants have to do here is take boats to two small villages called Capurganá and Acandí, and that's where they begin the long trek through the jungle into Panama. That happens every day. There's about 1,000 people passing through this town every day.
Wow.
The flow of people is constant. They get in boats that fit around 50 passengers, and they keep going through their trek.
You've reported from this area before, Manuel. How does the activity there today compare to what you've seen in the past?
Last time I was here, it was very disorganized because there were many people stranded here because Panama had decided to shut down its border. That's not the case anymore. Panama and Colombia are sort of trying to let people flow, sort of a very sophisticated, organized kind of operation where migrants pay for their ticket to get on the boat and they keep on going. Now there's a small minority who can't because they don't have enough money, and they sleep on the beach and try to do odd jobs in this town before they gather enough money to continue going. I mean, it must be said that to cross into Panama, you have to pay guides who take you, and they charge around $200, $300 per person, and paying them is obligatory.
I mean, the U.S. has been looking to restrict the flow of migrants, but it sounds like countries Panama and Colombia just want the kind of flow to keep moving north.
Yes, it's very hard for Colombia to control and to just say, oh, we're shutting down the Darien Gap. And when they've tried to shut it down, when Panama, for example, has restricted the flow somewhat, what people do is find even more remote, more dangerous routes, taking boats in the middle of the night and so forth, boats that can sink. So that tends to end up being more dangerous for the migrants.
Manuel, you've been speaking with people there at this point of entry into the dangerous Darien jungle. What do they know about the expiration of Title 42?
People follow this on social media, and many know the term Title 42. But what people who are making this journey really look at is firsthand information. So, you know, people are telling me that if they had a relative or a friend who was successful, they're going to keep on going. They're somewhat fearful that things might change after Title 42 expires, and that some country might try to, you know, block their passage to the United States. But they say, you know, that they have no option because right now it's very hard to get a visa.
Well, we heard Secretaries Blinken and Mayorkas talking about new policies that would impact migrants, like these processing centers that would allow people to avoid the Darien Gap, that especially treacherous piece of the jungle that claims so many lives. So the people you've been speaking with, is it clear how they would be affected by some of these policy changes?
Well, the processing centers were just announced yesterday. You know, we don't know where they're going to be located. It's not like there's a building yet. But I think the key will be, you know, how fast can people be granted visas? How much will it cost? What kind of paperwork will it require? Because the factors that push people to go to the Darien Gap is the difficulty of getting legal kind of visa or entry permit.
We also heard about a crackdown on human smuggling at the Darien Gap, Manuel. How would that affect people you're speaking with?
Well, what you got to keep in mind is that when we talk about smuggling, we got to think about, okay, who's doing the smuggling? And what's happening in this border between Colombia and Panama, basically, is that there's two villages where a large portion of the population now works taking migrants across the jungle. They lead the way, they show them the trails, they carry their suitcases, sometimes they rent them horses to take the little kids so that they don't have to walk so much. So we're talking about communities where hundreds of people are involved with this. So if there is really a crackdown, as the United States and Colombia said on paper, if that really happens, then it's going to create a big conflict with these border communities. And then it could also push the migrants themselves towards even more dangerous routes.
It is a complex situation. Reporter Manuel Ureda in Colombia at the entry point to the Darien jungle, speaking with us about the potential impact of new immigration rules on people waiting to cross through and make it to the United States-Mexico border. Manuel, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Something mysterious has been happening across Iran, a wave of poisonings in more than a dozen cities. They're happening in schools, mainly girls' schools. And so far, there's no clear explanation about who's responsible or why they're occurring. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Since last November, videos like this have surfaced online again and again. Parents rushing to schools, desperately trying to get their daughters to medical facilities. Students look sick. Some are gasping for air. Some are lying on the ground. Sometimes ambulances are on the scene. According to Amnesty International, more than 300 suspected chemical attacks have taken place across Iran, almost all at girls' schools. This 16-year-old student describes what happened at her school in Shahin Shahr, a city in central Iran. We're not naming her for her safety. She says on April 11th, as she was leaving her math class, she noticed a strange smell. Within a few minutes, students began to feel unwell, and then there was chaos. I fell to the ground and everything went black, she says. A human rights researcher shared this testimony with me. So far, no deaths have been reported from these incidents, but thousands of students have been hospitalized with symptoms like coughing, difficulty breathing, nausea, and vomiting. Teachers have been getting sick too. Teachers don't feel safe anymore, says this teacher from Khuzestan province in western Iran. One of her relatives got really sick, she says, but the school superintendent threatened to expel her if she didn't return to class. Iranian state media has been covering the story. Iranian officials are downplaying these incidents, even accusing the students of faking illness to avoid their schoolwork. Speaking on state TV, one expert blamed expired chocolate. Others say anxiety and stress are the real cause.
When they say that the girls themselves are committing the attacks, we ask, why and how?
Jasmine Ramsey is with the New York-based Center for Human Rights in Iran.
How could girls all across the country come up with these Academy Award-winning performances, you know, heaving and throwing up outside their classes? And why? Why would they be doing such a thing?
Ramsey says the timing of the poisonings is important. Iran has been witnessing mass protests since last September. They're in response to the death in police custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Jina Amini. She was arrested for not wearing proper hijab.
These schoolgirls were prominent participants in these protests, and they have anti-state views. They want a very different Iran.
During the protests, videos circulated online showing schoolgirls taking off their hijabs and shouting anti-government slogans. Sanam Naraghi Andarilini is the founder of the International Civil Society Action Network. It works with women in 40 different countries.
It's a fear tactic. It's a tactic to convince parents maybe not to send their girls to school, to convince girls to shut up and toe the line.
But if intimidation is the goal, it doesn't seem to be working. Students have continued to go to school, and some parents have taken matters into their own hands. Last week, a group of mothers camped outside their daughter's school to stand guard. The irony of all this, says Pegah Bani Hashemi, is that it's happening in Iran, which is basically a police state.
They use cameras to enforce hijab laws. Why can't these cameras be used to see who is gassing Iranian schoolgirls?
Bani Hashemi is a student at the University of Chicago Law School.
It is really sad that a place that should be a place of safety and peace for a student has now become a place of fear and terror for them and their families.
Iran's interior ministry says it has arrested 100 suspects connected to the poisonings, but none have been formally charged. Security forces have also arrested local reporters covering the story. Human rights activists say they want international organizations, including the United Nations, to carry out an independent investigation. But until then, Iranian students are still showing up for class every day, despite the possibility of new attacks. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
A panda bear named Yaya has returned to China after spending 2 decades at the Memphis Zoo. The giant panda was loaned to the U.S. as part of China's so-called panda diplomacy. China sends pandas across the globe as gestures of friendship. Recently, though, the vibes have not been so very friendly. There's been chatter in China that Yaya was not treated well at the zoo in Tennessee. Now, these are unsubstantiated rumors, but as is often the case, those rumors nod to a wider political and cultural tension between China and the U.S. It's worth asking, is panda diplomacy still working? To help answer, we reached out to journalist Gloria Dickey. Her new book is called 8 Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. Let's start with what panda diplomacy is exactly, Gloria. How long has it been going on?
So panda diplomacy has been around more or less since the 1940s, when the U.S., the Bronx Zoo, received pandas in exchange for helping fight the Japanese. But we have seen it take and evolve into different iterations over the decades. In the 1960s, we saw Nixon get 2 pandas from China. He sent back a couple musk oxen in exchange. But then beginning in the 70s, it kind of became more of a capitalist enterprise, if you will, in which China began charging loaner fees for their pandas to leave the country. More recently, we've seen China strategically use pandas as friendship envoys, in their words, kind of ursine bribes, if you will, to establish soft power around the world. Often countries that, you know, make trade deals with China will receive pandas shortly thereafter in exchange for those deals to go to their zoos.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember those pandas arriving at the Washington Zoo in 1972. It was such a big deal. So with the current news about Yaya, the giant panda, if the bears were historically used to represent friendship, what does it signal to you that there are accusations of mistreatment and mistrust, even if we don't know the specifics? I mean, is panda diplomacy breaking down?
Panda loans have always been a bit of a contentious issue between China and the U.S. So in the 90s, we saw the World Wildlife Fund, for example, sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for lax oversight on panda loans. And beginning in the late 90s, they required that part of the loaner fees paid to China would have to go towards wild panda conservation. And these fees can be up to $1 million per year per panda. But because China also owns all the property of a panda, from fur to blood to semen to any offspring that are born abroad, it's really easy for them to call pandas back home whenever they want. And in 2010, we saw a somewhat similar incident with the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. They had a bear named Tai Shan, and the U.S. was trying to extend his stay, and they begged for a few more years because he was a major attractant to the zoo. But around that same time, President Obama had met with the Dalai Lama, and that was upsetting to China, and they put Tai Shan on a flight back to China, where he remains today. I think a summary would be that China giveth the panda and China taketh the panda away, based on its relationships with countries to some extent.
You know, that's interesting. It occurs to me that pandas might be the only animal that that plays such a political role. I mean, yes, we've got elephants and donkeys and eagles, but they are symbolic. What are the pros and cons of making an animal like a panda becoming such a player in politics?
Well, I think it's tricky, too, because the panda only occurs in China, right? Like those other animals that might also perhaps have cultural clout, like the tiger, they're more wide-ranging. So one country can't really have supremacy over the tiger market, whereas that is the case with the panda market. And so I think, you know, because, you know, perhaps somewhat strategically, pandas have emerged as this kind of cultural zenith. You know, you kind of have spats between countries trying to get them. And the other reason is economics. Pandas attract huge audiences to zoos. I mean, even though their loan rental fees can be quite high, a lot of zoos will say the money they bring in with visitors, you know, completely counterbalances that.
Gloria, what are you going to be paying attention to most as we kind of look at this continuing evolution of panda diplomacy?
I think it'll be really interesting to see which countries we see getting more pandas and which countries begin getting fewer pandas. You know, Finland, for example, has gotten some pandas in recent years because of trade deals shored up with China. We saw Denmark also get some pandas after they essentially kind of recognized Chinese sovereignty over Tibet. So I think, you know, if we were to suddenly see a large influx of pandas into Russian zoos, you know, that might be of note. And if we were suddenly to see, you know, kind of the Western allied countries losing their pandas, that would also be of interest. I mean, a lot of the panda contracts are just, they have a timeline, they're set to expire. I think that, for example, Edinburgh Zoo is sending some pandas back later this year, and that's, you know, because the contracts run out and perhaps the zoo hasn't renewed. But certainly looking at where the pandas are flowing can kind of signal where global relations are.
Journalist Gloria Dickey's new book is called Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. It has a thorough chapter on the giant panda. The book comes out this summer. Gloria, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The United Nations Special Envoy for Haiti is urging immediate deployment of an international force to the country. The UN estimates that gangs now control up to 80% of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. In response, citizens are starting to take the law into their own hands. The Associated Press reports that residents armed with machetes, bottles, and rocks killed 13 suspected gang members in Port-au-Prince this week. Vonda Felbab-Brown with the Brookings Institute has been closely following the situation. What do we know about this incident in Port-au-Prince that saw 13 gang members killed, Vonda?
Well, it appears that a mob, citizens gathered in the place and pulled people from a bus that was manned by the Haitian National Police. The residents believe that this was gang members that were being escorted by the police and pulled them out in the Torrents, killed them brutally, and ultimately set the bodies on fire. And, you know, this is just part and parcel of the spiraling, not just violence, but really brutality that Haiti is experiencing.
Do we know if this vigilante attack on the gang members was spontaneous or plotted?
Well, it appears to be spontaneous, and it's not the first incident, but we have seen other cases of vigilante justice or injustice, certainly vigilante response across Haiti over many months as police really failed to hold or control the gangs in any meaningful way.
So you mentioned the bodies that were set on fire, these gang members. I mean, that's a type of execution that was common under the fearsome Tonton Macoute of Papa and Baby Doc Duvalier. Why has this grisly style of killing returned? Is it a message of some sort?
So it could be sort of a message hearkening back to the past. I think it's more emblematic, really, of the fear and that residents are living in and the sense that there is no one to protect them. And the gangs are very brutal even toward the areas that they nominally control. So it's not just that the rival gang is brutalizing the community. The gang that is controlling the community is brutalizing them.
What has been the reaction from official local police or leaders in Haiti?
Well, it's been muted. There has been some, you know, outrage and condemnation expressed by the local police. There really was not any significant effort, apparently, to stop the mob. The police feel brutalized by the gangs. Sometimes they are implicated in the gang violence as well and permeated by them. The reality is that grisly forms of insecurity, brutality are taking place on a daily basis. The national government really lacks the capacity to control it, hence these repeated calls for an international intervention.
So the UN Special Envoy for Haiti is pleading for an international intervention there. What can the UN actually do to stabilize the situation? What would that look like?
It's not just a country that's facing very brutal, increasingly powerful and spreading gangs, but it's a country where about half of the population is currently facing acute food insecurity. About half of the country's people don't have food to eat at the moment that we are speaking about. And it's really the UN humanitarian response that's keeping starvation, malnutrition, and the spread of diseases like cholera from getting more intense. The question is, what would an international intervention do? Just want to say right now that there is no appetite abroad, that I have been no takers to the calls by both Prime Minister Henry and the United Nations to mount such intervention force.
I mean, given the gangs, though, and the general dysfunction in Haiti, at some point, will the humanitarian situation just press an international intervention anyway?
Well, that's certainly possible. We are already seeing a significant number of Haitian people being internally displaced, about 130,000, as well as trying to flee. And, you know, 130,000 out of essentially 11 million, it's a very significant proportion. The people who have been displaced often have no access to basic necessities or food. We're also seeing significant flows of Haitians trying to leave the country. But at the same time, despite UN calls, people are being forcibly repatriated. So really very dire, very bleak situation inside Haiti, worsening steadily over months and, frankly, years. Very little prospect that some sort of stabilization could come from within Haiti. So it's very hard to imagine how, amidst the difficult humanitarian and deteriorating security situation, any stabilization could come from within. But on the outside, there's really been no interest by countries such as United States, Canada, Brazil, to mount an intervention.
So, Vanda, if non-state actors continue to assume control of Haiti, whether it's gangs or vigilantes going after gangs, what do you expect is going to happen? What's the long-term outlook?
In the absence of an international force, we are likely looking at intensification of the gang violence that's already assuming characteristics of civil war. The firepower of the gangs is large. They are increasingly buying illegally assault weapons in the United States and trafficking them into Haiti. Right now, there are still some institutions functioning in Haiti. They are weak at the national level. They lack legitimacy. They lack authority. But there is still some bureaucracies that are functioning. There are still processes that are functioning. But we could potentially be looking at collapse of those altogether.
Vanda Felbab-Brown is the director of the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors at Brookings, speaking with us about the current gang violence and reaction to it in Haiti. She joined us from Washington. Vanda, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
When meeting a stranger, it's always useful to have someone you trust vouch for them. Javon is a Brazilian music superstar you may not know of. He's been huge there for decades, and right now he's touring the U.S., the first time in 13 years. If you want an endorsement for Javon, turn to none other than Stevie Wonder. This is their 1982 collaboration, Samurai. Vocals from Javon, Stevie on harmonica. Faz que me mata, e se não mata, fere. To be you. No rumors of any surprise appearance of Stevie Wonder on this rare Javon tour of the States. But Javon's solo is more than enough to scratch your itch for an exciting night of music. If you want to see Javon live, he's in Fort Lauderdale tonight and tomorrow before heading west to Houston, Berkeley, and LA next week. Javon plays us out on this Friday. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a relaxing weekend. We'll see you right back here on Monday.